Justice by any means necessary.
A real dispute.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
So, hello everyone. Thank you for this invitation. I'm really glad, I'm really honored to be here, to speak to you and to speak with you. So, I will start my presentation. Let's talk a little bit about the reasons of this war. There is this idea that I heard a lot, being also on this conference, that the war started because NATO or the West in general has encroached on the Russian zone of influence, and that waging its war in Ukraine, Russia is kind of reacting to the Western threat. And this interpretation may lead to a conclusion with important political implications. If Russia started the war because the West would have violated its legitimate zone of influence, this means that the war could have been avoided or could eventually be ended if Russia's demands were met. So let's talk a bit about this perspective. Firstly, the underlying assumption of this logic is that NATO is an objective threat to the Russian security. Well, I want to make a quick reminder. Finland, which has a 1,300 kilometers of border with Russia, has joined the NATO last year. At the same time, no Russian troops have been moved to the Finnish border. They are all too busy with killing Ukrainians in Ukraine. So I ask, if NATO was an objective threat to Russia, why are there no troops and even no official propaganda in Russia presenting Finland as a military threat? So maybe it is not NATO that is threatening Putin, but something else. Secondly, this NATO-provoked Russia logic actually openly tells us that if you are a country that is not a great power like Russia, like China or the US, you have no right to sovereignty and you are forever condemned to be someone's zone of influence, or to put it simply, a colony. Your struggle for liberation is useless, so just deal with it. But even if we put aside all moral and ethical issues and admit that the key to world peace is maybe to accept that the world is divided into the zones of influence, what makes us think that sitting Ukraine will calm Putin down? The zone of influence Putin desires doesn't end in Ukraine or even in the post-Soviet space. Actually, I think it doesn't end anywhere, because any democratic country on the Russian border is a threat to the Putin's regime. But it's not a threat to the security of the Russian population. It's a threat to the security of the Putin's regime. So let me explain this. We tend to forget, but Putin hasn't always been an anti-West. It is only in 2011 that he began to say that Russia was in danger and this danger emanated from the West. What happened in 2011? Was it the year when a Western country was particularly aggressive towards Russia? Well, not really. The only thing that happened that year was that ordinary Russians took to the streets to protest against authoritarianism and extreme inequality of the Putin state. His fear of losing power resulted in a discourse that presented Russia as surrounded by enemies, and Putin as the only leader who could possibly protect Russia from this existential danger. This criminal war of imperialist aggression is not a response to an objective and external threat to Russia. This war is a response to a subjective and internal threat to the Russians, to the Putin's clan, who has seized control of the state apparatus and seized control of all the natural resources of this country. You know, it is not easy to preserve power in a country where 1% of the population owns 75% of the total wealth. That's why the regime does everything it can to suppress democratic tendencies in the neighborhood and its own country. That is why, for example, Putin sent its army to crush in blood the popular revolutions in Belarus and in Kazakhstan, where there was no question about Western influence, NATO whatsoever. It is not the so-called West that really threatens Putin, it is a desire of people to no longer live in corrupt, mafia-like, autocratic state. Ukraine is a country with which ordinary Russians have the greatest cultural proximity. And if it succeeds in building a democratic and prosperous state, it risks awakening dangerous ideas among Russians. They may ask themselves, if Ukrainians do not need an authoritarian and repressive state to live normally, why do we, Russians, need it? The suppression of Ukrainian independence was and is a key to internal stability of the authoritarianism in Russia. The ruling circles in Russia are genuinely obsessed with the idea that if Ukraine escapes from under control, it will inevitably infiltrate Russia with subversive ideas of democracy or republicanism or whatever, and even feminism, and this is the personal obsession of Putin. And then the autocratic system that holds the vast and fragile Russian imperial space will be ruined. That is why to crush in blood democratic aspirations of the population of Ukraine and to make it immune to influences emanating, at least from the West, is essential for Putin. That is why to turn Ukrainians into loyal Russians is perceived as an existential mission. Ukrainians must become Russians or disappear. So Putin and his entourage started this war following the logic of ontological security, not a physical security. It has nothing to do with the objective military threat whatsoever, but it has everything to do with the subjective fears of the Russian ruling classes. And this is something we must keep in mind if you want to understand the logic behind the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And especially if you want to speak about the possible solutions to end this war. The demand that we share, both the Ukrainian left and anti-authoritarian left in Russia, is the defeat of Putin's regime. On one hand, he's massacring Ukrainians. On the other, he's sending hundreds of thousands of Russians like cannon fodder into a war they have no reason to wage. Socialny Rukh, my organization, and Russian Socialist Movement even published a joint manifesto at the very start of the invasion where we explained it. But it seems sometimes that the opinions of Ukrainian and Russian socialists count for less than those of Western self-acclaimed experts who have never set foot in Ukraine or Russia. Of course, it's not even a question. Of course, we must oppose American imperialism, especially when we are in the US. But if we think that the only so-called West is imperialist, we find ourselves de facto supporting the ruling classes of countries which claim to be oppressed by the United States, but which in reality are seeking to redistribute the spheres of domination. The Western left often finds itself justifying the actions of Chinese, Russian, or Iranian ruling classes on the pretext that they are directed against the United States. Some left-wing activists being maybe too busy challenging American imperialism, start to feel, unfortunately, more proximity with Putin than with the working men and women who are fighting for their dignity in Russia. And for with ordinary men and women who are fighting simply for their right to exist as a society in Ukraine. The geopolitical approach is incompatible, for me, with left political values, because it renders invisible the working class. And if we think in terms of class solidarity, and not in terms of state interests, then how can we not be in solidarity with those who are fighting for freedom, whether against the imperialism of the United States, or China, or Russia? To welcome the rise of non-Western imperialism because they represent a so-called multipolar alternative to Western hegemony would be kind of irresponsible towards those who will actually experience the consequences of this multipolar world first, because this world emerged, this emergence of the multipolar world passed through wars and strengthening of dictatorships. The multipolar world promoted by Putin, Modi, Xi Jinping, Bolsonaro, Trump, Erdogan will be a wonderful place for dictators and the far right. But it would be a hell for us, workers, ethnic minorities, women, LGBT people, and all liberation movements. Faced with fascist, ultra-conservative, and authoritarian forces, we must act. And Putin is counting on our moral laziness and short memory. So I would like to ask, let's not betray our class. Let's not forget that being socialist means to stay in solidarity with the oppressed, against all the oppressors. Russia was engaged in a strategy of terror against civilians, bombing residential areas. Ukrainians live under the threat of missiles that can reach any part of the country at any time. Meanwhile, civilians, including children who have found themselves under Russian occupation, are victims of forced displacement, murder, rape, and torture on a mass scale. But despite the horrors of this war, people are extremely engaged into armed and non-armed resistance. They are organizing themselves from below. And in the face of the extreme violence of the Russian invasion, all civic and political forces, including trade unions, including left organizations, are engaged in resistance and self-organization. But the Ukrainian authorities, what they do, they try to put the burden of war on the poorest. They launched a liberalization program. They are undertaking antisocial reforms. They try to dismantle labor legislation. So, as the representatives of the Ukrainian left, we ask two things. We ask to increase military, financial, and diplomatic support for the Ukraine, for the Ukrainian state. But we also fight to ensure that the world is not used to favor the oligarchs and corporations at the expense of the working people. And Ukrainians need support so their state could stay independent, democratic, and become pluralistic, inclusive, and social oriented. And in this battle for freedom and dignity, that the Ukrainians workers, they need a support from the international left. Thank you very much.
Hello everyone, thank you so much for this opportunity to talk to you for this very important session on ongoing imperialist war in Ukraine. First of all, I will say that I totally agree with the previous speaker in her analysis of the internal reasons of this war from the side of Putin. Definitely, the start of this war was the type of answer to the growth of the anti-authoritarian resistance in Russia, to the growth of protests, And you should understand that it was the long path to this war. So Russian society was prepared, was brainwashed during last 8 years for this war. This war important in terms of very radical transformation of the Putin's political regime in Russia into a type of the open, repressive, semi-fascist dictatorship. But it's also important to understand its open imperialist character. So I know that unfortunately still there's very kind of reduced understanding of imperialism, which has dominated among the international left, which is trying to explain imperialism as a sort of pure economic interest, as the interest of the big capital. It's important to notice, firstly, that in Russia, the capital, the big capital, doesn't exist as the kind of agent, as an independent player. There is no any autonomy of the big capital from the state. And during the 20 years of Putin's rule, Russia was transformed into something that is, some researchers call the Russia Incorporated. So it's a huge, it's reality. So it worked like a huge corporation, maybe according to the sweet dreams of the Silicon Valley, you know, cultures. So that is the corporation. You have one person in the top of this corporation, and you have his managers who basically control some parts of the wealth of the natural sources and so on. But in fact, they are totally politically dependent. They are subordinated from the top, and all their wealth is just a type of a pocket, one of the pockets of the chief of the corporation. That's why, of course, all the ideas behind the liberal elites in US and Western Europe that, well, Russian ruling class can split, you know, we should push the sanctions against the Russian big capital in order to you know, split it with Putin and so on. So all that came from the very poor understanding of the very nature of the Russian capital, how this system is organized. And I think it's much more important to talk about the interest of this state corporation, its political ambitions, its political, let's say, imagination, and its struggle for the territorial control, especially over the post-Soviet space. Actually, great American Marxist thinker David Harvey explained it in his book New Imperialism that basically, imperialism knows it's not just about the economical logic, but it's also about political territorial logic. And you can see this logic behind all the attempts of Russia to spread its control in the post-Soviet space. In 2008 in Georgia, in the war with Georgia, then in 2014 in the beginning of military involvement in the east of Ukraine, the annexation of Crimea, and then the current war. So this this type of imperialist approach is something that is totally opposite for any sort of let's say soft power of any sort of hegemony. So definitely Russia lost any sort of hegemony, ideological hegemony in the post-Soviet states, which mean that all the peoples of the states in the post-Soviet countries, they clearly understand that the current Russian ideology of so-called Russian world is immediate, direct threat for the very existence of them as the nations. And it's not just about Ukraine. Of course, Putin is very much obsessed of Ukraine because of the revolutionary experience of 2014 and also because of the very special place of Ukraine in, let's say, pan-Slavic, great Russian historical imagination. But after Ukraine, if Putin will succeed in Ukraine, he will go further. So you already have an open trade to countries like Moldova or Georgia or even Baltic states. And of course, if you want to understand the role of NATO and this idea of NATO and enlargement, you have to understand it without any justification of NATO, not only from the side of US, but from the side of all these countries, like Baltic states, like Georgia, like Poland. So for these countries, NATO, it's a question of of guarantee for their independent existence. So if you recognize the agency of these countries, and I think that we have to recognize it as the true internationalists, we should understand that the question of enlargement of NATO is much more complicated than just the pure will of American elite. So what happened in Russia after? After the beginning of this war. So during 1 week, all the previous structure of the Putin's authoritarian regime, which allowed some very, very limited like civil liberties, like freedom of speech. So you would not call what we have before the start of the war freedom of speech, but I think if you compare it with what you have now, it was like this. At least some independent media were existed. There was some opportunity to have political meetings, not such a big one as this, but maybe a bit smaller. Of course, it was some kind of freedom of speech in the social media. So all of this was destroyed in just a week after the beginning of the war. A number of new repressive laws were implemented. For example, the law on distributing so-called fake news about the special military operation in Ukraine, which means that if you distribute any other information that is different from the official statements of the Russian Ministry of Defense, you could be arrested and you can spend in prison up to 7 years. Other things, there is another law about the discreditation of the army, about justification of terrorism, spreading gay propaganda. So all this set of repressive laws were implemented or were developed, because we already had a quite open criminalization of LGBT people, but for now it became like total. So you any public expression of your let's say belonging to the LGBT community is totally prohibited. It's criminal. Yeah? All the independent media were shut down, and any expression of the anti-war feelings were immediately punished in a very brutal manner. I will say that to the end of last year, Russia already had much more political prisoners than, for example, during Brezhnev times in the Soviet Union. So now we are coming to the direction of, studying terms. Because the present terms, they're really already comparable to times of great terror. So just for some words, you could go to prison for up to 10 years. And this wave of repressive wave is expanding. You know that just a few weeks ago, well-known Russian socialist writer Boris Kagarlinsky was arrested. He is now in prison, and probably he can get 7 years of prison for so-called justification of terrorism. There are much more examples of this, and the real meaning of this repression was to create the atmosphere of fear, the atmosphere of atomization, of fear even in between communication of the people between each other, and the total domination of the official propaganda. So just a few days ago, like 1st of September, it's the start of the new year in Russian schools and Russian universities and so on. So from this year, we have a full, ideologization of the education. We have a new textbook on Russian history with all the story about Ukrainian fascism, the reasons for the special military operation, the greatness of Russia, the Western conspiracy against Russia during the centuries, and so on. We have a new course for all the students of all the universities, which is necessary to teach, and it's called the DNA of Russia. So the main idea that okay, you are a Russian citizen, but you don't get the idea of it. Yeah, so, and this is about how to understand your identity. And of course, your identity is to be a part of organic, national community, to belong to the Russian Empire, which was always right, which was always just in its expansion, and which is somehow rooted in your DNA. So it's openly a kind of race theory that we have on the official level in Russia, and I will totally support the thesis of Anna that is the war of the regime, that is a war in the interest of this regime, that is a war in the interest of the Russian state, but not in the interest of the Russian society, which already lost more than 50,000 soldiers. So it's already more than two Chechen wars and the war in Afghanistan altogether. And also, so it's already affected Russian society a lot, of course, not of the size than Ukraine, but it's already the biggest challenge for the Russian society since the Second World War. And all of this was because of the existence of this regime and its interests. So I think it's extremely important to understand this trend, this situation in Russia, the reasons for this war, and take it not as the unique example, not a unique Russian story, but as the global challenge, as a global threat of authoritarianism, of the far right rhetorics, far right ideology, and the geopolitical imperialist vision of the world, of the country, its neighbors, and so on. And I will say that together with the solidarity for the people of Ukraine, for their struggle, it's important to to express a solidarity for the anti-war movement in Russia, because this movement is really heroic. So you have already a lot of people who are in prison, or who are in a very risky situation, or were forced to leave the country. Some of them, by the way, left to US, crossing the Mexican-American border. So I think that is very important, and that should be part of our message for the American socialists. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to present. And I would like to mention that there's like still seats at the middle of the audience. There are still seats at the middle of the audience for those people who are, I appreciate your commitment for sitting here. But you don't have to suffer, there's still. So I would like to start by talking about the cost of war for Ukrainian society. So in a recent poll done in June, at the end of June, and I quote, 78% of Ukrainians have close relatives or friends who were injured or killed due to the Russian invasion. 78%. I continue. On average, the respondents reported 7 close friends or relatives killed or injured. It's just enormous cost. And what do people say? So again, different poll in June, Dan say 84% say, under no circumstances should Ukraine give up any of its territory. Even because of this, the war will last longer and there will be threat to the preservation of independence. 84%. And this poll, by the way, has been done by a number of organizations inside Ukraine, and even international organizations, the same numbers. 68% of people say that we should continue to try to liberate of all of Ukraine, including Crimea, if that means a longer war with Russia and diminishing help from the West. 68%. Now, much more interesting poll. 89% of respondents said that we should carry on fighting even if Russia is using a tactical nuclear weapon against a Ukrainian city. 89%. So there is no way on hell on earth Ukrainians will give up fighting. There's just no way. And because the cost is very great, as previous two speakers explained, and there's absolutely no reason to believe, as Ilya said, there's no evidence to believe that Russia will stop with Ukraine. That brings us to a very important issue, the nuclear dimension of this war, which is very, very important. We had a session at this conference yesterday. The Ukraine had the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world in the 90s. In 1994, Ukraine signed the Budapest Memorandum. It's a colloquial name, the Budapest Memorandum, please look it up, where it gave up its nuclear arsenal and in exchange for its territorial and sovereign recognition and security assurances from the United States, the United Kingdom, and Russia. Obviously, in 2014, Russia violated this agreement to pretty much all the tenants. And even though it's called the Budapest Memorandum, because it's called the Memorandum in English, actually, because it didn't go through the US Senate. That's the reason, actually, Clinton made it a memorandum, but actually, it's basically, in fact, like a treaty-like document. It's registered with the United Nations. It's a very major piece of documentation and a part of a very larger law, which is called Non-Proliferation Treaty on Nuclear Weapons. So Ukraine demilitarized, and in fact, in the Declaration of Independence, it said that Ukraine will denuclearize, and it did. Now, we got the violations of this treaty, the violation of Turkey's sovereignty. So what I would like to argue is that the military and humanitarian aid of the United States and UK is not only morally justified, but has legal basis. And it's very sad that only on the US side, only Ted Cruz and Mitt Romney mentioned this document, actually before the large invasion, but they don't mention it. So this is very sad. If we are for some kind of international law, this is a major piece of international law. I would like to mention that there is an interesting book published recently about the history of denuclearization of nuclear, post-nuclear space called Inheriting the Bomb, about this story. Now, very famous American revolutionary socialist, John Mersheimer, wrote in wrote in before the Budapest Memorandum was signed. He wrote an article in Foreign Affairs arguing that Ukraine should not give up its nuclear weapons because otherwise, guess what? He predicted there will be war. Russia will attack Ukraine. John Mersheimer, the very same John Mersheimer. But no, you see, that was not the spirit. It was a demand from Ukrainian society. It was a very complex issue, giving up nuclear weapons with lots of support, public support. Now, another important document that Ukraine is part of is Treaty on Conventional Armed Forces in Ukraine. The treaty was signed in the 1990s between the Soviet Union, overall actually like Warsaw Pact, not just Soviet Union, Warsaw Pact and NATO, where basically both NATO and Warsaw Pact demilitarized. And when I said, what does mean demilitarized mean? It means that Ukraine actually moved its tank, conventional weapons, to Russia. And the same happened with nuclear weapons. They didn't disappear. These weapons were moved to Russia. The strategic bombers were moved to Russia. The missiles were moved to Russia. The thing that was destroyed was only silos. The thing that you couldn't move from Ukraine. The silos and the factories. And now the same missiles, the same bombers actually are used against Ukrainian cities. So, and again, Treaty of Conventional Armed Forces, interesting fact, historical fact about this treaty is that 2007 Russia suspended this cooperation in this treaty. What happened in 2008? Russia invaded Georgia. And now officially Russia is out of this treaty between NATO and Warsaw Pact. So here you go. Now another very, very critical dimension, nuclear, part of the nuclear dimension of the war is the situation with the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. As you know, it's under Russian occupation. I have conducted interview with a trade unionist who are in the plant, with connection to the plant. There was many, not me, just many progressive journalists were did the same thing. And the situation is very awful. The plant operates in a very, nuclear power plants are very, very delicate infrastructure, and you don't want them to be in the war zone, which is what they are in. And it's very, even though it's not right now in the news, but the situation is very dangerous. In fact, so we have here, I have a QR code, and please come to see. We have a petition which we believe it can bring at least this part of the conflict could be successfully mitigated. This petition was co-authored with the Ukrainian Social Solidarity Network and also comrades from Ukraine. The idea is that we could use the Suez Canal crisis as an international precedent to actually establish a demilitarized zone around Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant. So at least that somehow security of that plant can be at least guaranteed. Because the things right now are very, very, very dangerous. Like there's not enough staffing. Staff is being harassed by FSB, the Russian security services, physically, emotionally. Maintenance is not being performed as it is supposed to. What's interesting is that it's very important to recognize we are right now participating in an experiment, nuclear experiment, because there have been not ever a precedent for the nuclear power plant to be in either cold or hot shutdown for such a long time. The plants are not, nobody knows what are the consequences of the plant to be in this cold or hot shutdown regime. They were not designed, so there's an experiment. And if you read the media reports, and unfortunately my friends, colleagues in the nuclear policy community have complained to me personally about this, you know, when you read about the reports, they say, oh, you know, this plant is not Chernobyl. This is not going to be bad. But, you know, Fukushima was not Chernobyl. It was not the Chernobyl design. This is not an argument. So if somebody tells you this cannot be like a show, we cannot guarantee. There's no way. So many things can go wrong there, and with different degree of impact. You know, I don't want to be alarmist to say it's only Chernobyl version is possible, but it's a whole spectrum of possibilities. But at least establishing demilitarized zone will really, really, you know, help us to prevent this nuclear catastrophe. Also, I would like to draw your attention, if you want to read about the situation more. The Union of Concerned Scientists has a very interesting piece of report about what could go wrong and sort of the assessment. Finally, I would like to mention that International Atomic Energy Agency is, of course, is on site and does some monitoring, and we have some information from them. It's one of the sources of information. But very few of you know that the head of the Department of Nuclear Energy at International Atomic Energy Agency is Mikhail Chudakov, who was a former Rosatom manager. So we said it's a conflict of interest here. Little bit former Rosatom, but the Rosatom claim it's to be stationed because it's annexed by, the territory is annexed by Russia from the Russian point of view. And the head of the agency, the national agency is supposed to be impartial, is actually former Rosatom manager. So please again, come to see me, stand by at the Ukrainian Solidarity Network table downstairs to consider signing this and promoting this petition. And unfortunately, I have to share my personal experience with trying to promote this petition that many so-called pro-peace left activists, this petition just asks for establishing demilitarized zone, usually the General Assembly, UN General Assembly, with a well-established international precedent. Nobody wants to support this. Nobody. So if you are guys, what's wrong? Like, what was this? You know, like, so this just tells you that Russian imperialism somehow is not an imperialism, and it's because it's against US, and it just absolutely makes no sense. And so finally, I would like to ask you that why Ukrainian society at large needs supportive progressive organizations in the West, in the United States specifically. It's because Ukrainian democracy is still developing, and since it's many people are in the army, right? Many working class, it's a people's war basically. In the army, they have demands, they have political demands, they have economic demands. The more there is solidarity, progressive solidarity with the Ukrainian workers that are fighting Russian army, the more democratic and progressive society will be after the war. And I would like to remember this, right? The more solidarity expressed with the people of Ukraine, the more democratic and progressive society will be. And this is actually the words which were told by the head of actually Socialist Group today to me. And finally, I would like to say that victory to Ukraine, democracy for Russia, and peace in Europe.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.